Okay. So the topic for this morning is this has become heated in the last few years in Israel, is the question of civil marriage in Israel. So just a bit of background. So at the moment in Israel, there is basically no civil marriage at all. That's not 100% true, but that's basically true. Now, the reason for this is a series of historical anomalies. But basically, before Israel was the State of Israel, it was under the British Empire, and before that, it was under the Ottoman Empire. And in the Ottoman Empire, there was no civil marriage. Marriage was controlled by religious institutions. Each religion in the Ottoman Empire ran marriage for its constituents. That
what
was
did
just
marriage signify at that point in time, other than part under the auspices of religion. Like, did it have any impact in governmental things?
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly, but you know, I'm sure it's become more complicated. But there were tax implications, and there were. Under the Ottoman Empire, I assume there were also, I would have to check, but I assume there were legal ramifications to adultery, right?
Yeah.
I assume, right? It was under Muslim rule. Like, there are legal implications to marriage. So under the Ottoman Empire, each religion ran marriage, and then when the British took over, they continued the policy of the Ottoman Empire. So by time the State of Israel was founded in 1948, this had just been what had been going on for a very long time, that marriage was controlled by religious institutions, right? Before we get to modern Israel, it's not like, you know, the Rabbanut started this notion. In a sense, like the West, what we have in Western society, in America, Canada, right? That's the novelty, right? That was the advent of modern times. But you know, the Israel is a holdover. I mean, literally, it's a holdover from the Ottoman Empire. So when the British took over, they kept it, and then when Israel became a state, they kept it as well. Now, the way that happened was that Ben-Gurion, when he was building a coalition at the beginning of the state, he wanted to create as big a coalition as he could, and I don't mean that just in the political sense, meaning, you know, in the formal political sense, like members of the Knesset. But he also wanted to present a unified front when the state would be declared. So one of the things that he did was that the Haredi community at the time, this wasn't, again, they weren't part of the coalition in the Knesset, but what Ben-Gurion wanted was that even though the Haredi establishment was anti-Zionist, he didn't want them to come out and protest the declaration of a state. He thought that would be bad for public relations. You know, here the UN was agreeing to partition Israel to give the Jews a state, and he felt it would be disastrous if there were prominent leaders who came out and said this was a bad idea, right? Don't give us a state. So what he wanted was not for them to come out and endorse the state. He wanted them just to stay quiet. Right, so that the public view of the community would be in favor of the Jewish state. So what he did was he wrote a letter to the Aguda and to the representatives of the Haredi community, and in he traded with them, and he said, basically, for your silence. And now the Haredi community was very small at the time. This wasn't right. And this was more that he wanted a unified front, so it wasn't that they, you know, controlled anything, but he wanted a unified front. He said, I'm willing to trade willingness for a unified front for four things. And this, the letter that he wrote became known as the status quo letter, and the agreements he made in it became known as the status quo agreements, simply because, again, he wasn't promising them anything which was new, but rather he was promising that certain things would remain the same. And one of them this was the fourth one, was that marriage and divorce would be continued to be controlled by the religious, by the religious institutions. Now, in 1948, what that meant was the Orthodox rabbinate. There was no other rabbinate in the country. It meant it would be controlled by the Orthodox rabbinate, and they would control citizens' freedom to choose who to marry. And the like, and therefore anyone who couldn't halachically marry could not civilly marry in Israel either. They did not promise anything else, right? They didn't promise anything else would be recognized by the state. The state would not be halachic, but marriage and divorce would remain under the auspices of the rabbin. And if you just skip to three, right, this is the translation of the status quo letter, right? Marital law. All the members of the executive appreciate the seriousness of the problem and the grave difficulties pertaining to it, and all the bodies representing the agency's executive do whatever possible to satisfy the deep need of the religiously observant in this matter, lest the house of Israel be divided in two. And Ben-Gurion said the reason he was willing specifically to continue this part of the status quo is that marriage and divorce isn't just another halachic thing. Right? It's not just, you know, the Haredi community was less worked up about, let's say, everybody keeping kosher. They didn't care. But the problem with marriage is that if you don't give control of marriage to the rabbinate, you run the risk of people getting married, let's say, halachically, and then, you know, let's say, becoming, right, they're halachically committed when they're married, and then they are not halachically committed when they divorce, so they just separate, and then their children are mamzerim, and then the children want to become frum again, but now they can't marry into the community, right? Marriage creates all types of unique issues, and therefore it was important that marriage stay under the auspices of the rabbinate. So that was the agreement that he made. Now the irony of this whole thing was that this status quo agreement was really only the people who really liked it were at certain level the secular and the Haredim. The only people who really didn't like it at the time were religious Zionists, for opposite reasons. I give this to you in two from Elie Fischer. Right, basically as follows, right? The secular Zionists obviously didn't want any halachic involvement with the state, so they might not have been thrilled by this, but they also didn't care so much, right? Meaning this was a concession. They wanted as little halachic involvement in the state as was possible, and if this is what they had to trade, you know, they had to give marriage, okay, they may not have been thrilled with it, but they didn't, you know, whatever. As long as it was minimal, okay, so we'll trade. But, you know, obviously it was up to them, so there would be no religious elements in the state of Israel. It would have just been a democracy. The Haredi community wanted to get as much as it could, and marriage was at the top of their list of things that they cared about. But, you know, they didn't have anything more than a practical commitment to halacha being enshrined in state law, because they didn't believe in the value of the state. They just wanted practically to protect the community. Religious Zionists, on the other hand, saw the state of Israel as the realization of, you know, sort of messianic proportions. So the concessions that only certain things would be run by halacha and not everything actually created a philosophical dilemma for religious Zionists, because, you know, the fact that it was only marriage, right, that we were willing to trade marriage and then say, okay, but there won't be, the state won't be religiously run, was actually a huge concession for people who were committed to seeing the state as a religious, you know, as sort of a religious institution. They were not thrilled that the only thing that remained was marriage, and then like a few, certainly, you know, that Shabbos would be the day of rest, but not that people would, you know, Shabbos is not imposed, it's the day of rest for the community, and kashrus would be kept in, you know, communal institutions. Those were big victories, but the fact that halacha didn't have more of involvement in the state was a problem. But that's basically what happened, and that's how we got to where we are today. Okay, that's just a bit of historical background. Now, so to what extent do you have civil marriage in Israel right now? And then we'll get into the halachic issues once we just sort of dispense with this. There are two ways, there are two senses in which we have civil marriage in Israel right now. One is that based on international treaties, any marriage performed abroad must be recognized by the state of Israel. And that's just standard, right? By international treaty, right? Ora and I got married in Toronto, right? We go back to the States, right? I don't need to file for another marriage license. My marriage was recognized in the States. I just needed to provide evidence that I got married in Canada, and it's automatically registered in the States. And the same is true in Israel. So if people get married abroad, so then they can be civilly married in Israel. However, divorce will still be under the auspices of the rabbinate if they want to get divorced in the state. They can get divorced outside the state if they want, but if they want to get divorced in the state, then divorce is still under the auspices of the rabbinate, but their marriage will be recognized. And therefore, there are people who, if they can't get halachically married or they don't want to get halachically married, they will go to usually Cyprus, right? Usually Cyprus. And they'll get married there. Right? It's a half-hour flight. They'll get married abroad. They'll come back. There are a lot who come to Toronto also. Whatever. That's just the way it is.
Wait, so if you get civilly married, would you still have to go through the rabbinate to get...
divorced.
But, like, and with a get and everything,
yes,
too? But it's,
yes,
a civil marriage. It wasn't...
Right, so we'll come to that in a second. But yes, right? If you want to get divorced in the state, you have to go through the rabbinate. And the rabbinate might demand a divorce, even if you only had a civil marriage, for reasons that we'll get to in a few minutes. The second thing is that Israel does have what's called domestic union cards, where you can decide not to get married in Israel, but you can be... can have a civil union, which for legal purposes does give you most of the rights of marriage. Most of the rights of marriage, not all of them, but many of the tax implications, inheritance implications, some of the health proxy implications, you will already get through domestic unions. So if you don't care to be married, you just want certain things, you can get a domestic union in Israel. Yeah.
So in regards to adultery, that isn't an issue, though, right? Even if it's done through the rabbinate. Like, here we also have you get married through Canada. Like, you don't actually get in trouble with the government if there's an issue of adultery. But in the rabbinate, would that not be an issue?
So in Israel, the rabbinate has no criminal jurisdiction. So you can't, or obviously you can't be, you can't be punished criminally for adultery in Israel, but because the rabbinate is control of divorce, there can be financial implications if you get divorced, right? Because the rabbit, right? Because if a woman commits adultery, so then she loses her ksuba, and if you go to the rabbinate and you get divorced by the rabbinate, and they adjudicate the financial settlement, there can be implications financially. It's a bit more complicated than that because you can get divorced by the rabbinate and have the financial settlement worked out by the secular court. The secular court does have financial jurisdiction. In Israel, they actually have equal jurisdiction over the financial one. So whichever court you go to first gets jurisdiction over finances. So if you get to Beis Din first, then it will be adjudicated by Beis Din. If you get to the secular court first, it will be adjudicated by the secular court. And apparently this was the line that I said in Thornhill that got quoted the most, was that, but this is sort of well known, that when people decide to get divorced, it tends to be that the woman will run to the secular court and the man will run to Beis Din, because on balance, the civil court will benefit the woman and the Beis Din will benefit the man. It's not always true, but that's often the upshot of what happens. And therefore, you know, because whoever gets there first, you know, gets jurisdiction, then there's a race. There's a race to see which court you can get to, which is not a good situation to be in. But that is that's sort of the reality in Israel. So that's, you know, the very short, even though it took 15 minutes, that's a short background of how we got to the situation that we're in, where Israel basically only has civil marriage, has religious marriage rather, and no internal capability of civil marriage. Now, this creates certain problems in the state. So what problems do you think it creates? Right. Some of them you can see, and probably some of them you,
yeah, they forbid a lot of marriages.
What? Right, so one is the problem is that if marriage is controlled by halacha, so that means that any not halachically sanctioned marriages can't be recognized, but can't happen in the state. So there are certain which, you know, happen sometimes, like a kohen to a grusha and things like that. That happens sometimes. The bigger problem is
the Russians who came in.
Is intermarriage, right? It's potential intermarriage. And then you could have people who, right, so if it's a non-Jew to a non-Jew, you don't have a problem.
Right.
But if you, and even, but if it is someone who either is not Jewish, who wants to marry someone Jewish, or the bigger problem, people who feel Jewish, right, think they're Jewish, but can't prove their Jewishness to the rabbinate, or are, you know, patrilineally Jewish, and therefore consider themselves Jews, but the rabbinate does not, they can't get married in Israel. There is no recourse, because since one of them is undeniably Jewish, if both of them are not Jewish, then you have no problem, right? But if one of them is halachically Jewish and can prove that to the rabbinate, and the other one isn't, so then
if they're
you're
not
stuck.
Jewish, though, don't they have to go through another religious institution? Like, there's no...
Yeah. What if they're both not Jewish, but they
right.
both consider themselves
so
Jewish?
Where would they go?
So they both do, so then I'm not sure what they do. They can... If they're both, you know, I don't know, if they're both patrilineal Jews, I don't actually know who takes care of it. But the rabbinate would have no problem with that, so I don't know.
So there's, like, a rabbinate for Christianity and a rabbinate for Islam, like, all...
Well, Islam, for sure. I mean, Christianity is not, yeah, it's not a rabbinate, but yes, they are,
cool.
they do have it, yes. Meaning, Israel, right, so it's not... It's not technically true that marriage is run in Israel by the rabbinate. It's that marriage is run by the religious institutions. Most of the marriages that are under the rabbinate, but obviously, well, I don't know, even most, right? The Jewish marriages are under the rabbinate. The Muslim marriages are under
Sharia,
are under Sharia law, and Christian marriages are under. I have no idea who the representatives governmentally are of this, but that is the reality in Israel, right? It's not under the rabbinate exclusively, but. So this creates serious problems.
How would they deal with divorce?
What?
How would they deal with divorce with the marriages they don't normally recognize? Like, they recognize that the people, like, went out of the country.
So we'll come to that in just a second, right? So, but the big problem in Israel, right, is one is people who can't get married halachically and want to get married. At least one of them is Jewish, right? This is a problem. This is a political problem, which is tied into the conversion problem, which is its own nightmare, right? Then, obviously, you have other marriages which are forbidden, halachically, right? So, kohen grusha, fine, but also homosexual, right, unions are a problem if people want to get married. So, obviously, halacha doesn't recognize it, so they can't get married. You have a different set of problems, right? Meaning, you won't have a divorce problem, right, as opposed to other cases where you might, but if they want to get married, they can't do it. In the state. Now, ironically, and this is something I gave you in 4, is that Israel's total lack of civil marriage actually enables gay couples to have more rights than they do in other states where there isn't gay marriage. Like, until the states recognized gay marriage, right, there wasn't really an avenue for civil union in the same way for gay couples either. In Israel, there was, because since there is a strong culture of domestic union partnerships, for people who don't want to get married but just want the financial benefits of it, that can be between anybody, right? I mean, you can come up with whatever financial agreements. So ironically, even though they don't have gay marriage until sort of the states had gay marriage, gay couples had more rights in Israel than they did, let's say, in the states, because they could get a domestic union, which because it's not marriage at all, right, it's just a financial agreement. There was no opposition in Israeli law to that. So that's another...
Adopt
what?
Kids, though. Isn't that the newest law that came out recently?
In where? In Israel?
Those that are in... Yeah, they can't actually adopt children.
I don't know. That's possible.
I think that's new, though. But
that's possible. Laws are always changing.
Yeah. If these gay couples go to the States and get married and then come back to Israel,
their marriage is recognized.
Considered.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah, there are some high-profile cases where that happened, right?
Yeah, I saw a video recently of three different couples, two of which were gay, and then one was like, I can't get married in Israel if the state doesn't recognize my friends as getting married, and they came to New York and all got married on the same day together. Then
right, so there were some high-profile kids even before, like, America. Like, if you've read, have you read Sapiens? You know Sapiens? Mm-hmm. Right, so Yuval Harari, who's a, like, you know, a professor at U of T, he was a visiting professor at U of T. The reason he was visiting professor at U of T was because he's gay, and he wanted to get married to his partner, so he went abroad from Israel, mm-hmm. right? He's a professor at Hebrew U. He got married in Toronto and then eventually went back, right?
I didn't know that. That's cool.
You can tell, actually, if you read his book.
Yeah.
Because right, he has a whole sort of, there's like a whole part of the book which is, you know, well, he doesn't talk about it. It's about, you know, it's a scientific explanation of why, you know, much of Western society is backwards. But that, you know, right? He's explaining his own life journey. That's why the whole book also scientifically explains why Buddhism is the right religion, because he's a Buddhist, right? He's a Zen Buddhist. You know, like okay, like it's not whatever. Anyways, okay. Now we get to the halachic part. Okay, so now there have been recent pushes in Israel to have civil marriage, and then there's been a lot of pushback to having civil marriage in Israel. So now we move to the halachic questions, right? What halachic issues could there be in having civil marriage? Why would you think it's a good idea? Why would you think it's a bad idea? Okay, I throw it out to you. Right. What questions do we have to answer? Now, one question we already talked about is let's jump to the most serious halachic question here. But then we'll get to some of the others. So I mentioned that many marriages that are done abroad will still run into questions of divorce in the rabbinate. Now, why is that true?
Well, what is marriage? Marriage, from my understanding, I've heard that like if you have sex with your partner with the intent of being married, then you're considered married.
Right. So one of the biggest questions you have to answer is, well, is civil marriage halachic marriage? Right. Because if civil marriage is halachic marriage, so then by allowing civil marriage, the assumption is that civil marriage, if you allow civil marriage, you're also going to allow civil divorce. That may not be true, and we'll come to people who suggest that won't be true. But the simplest understanding is if you introduce civil marriage into Israel, you will have to have civil divorce. Now, that might be a problem. So, is civil marriage halachic marriage? So this was a huge machlokas in the States in the 1950s and on between the two leading poskim in the States, between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin.
I should say, like, definitely not, because he had to deal with some mamzerim issues.
Correct. Right. So Rav Moshe Feinstein felt that no marriage, except for halachic marriage, is marriage. Right. And his argument is very simple: if you don't want to get married halachically, then you're not married halachically. Now, the Gemara has a chazaka, a presumption that ein adam oseh bi'ilaso bi'ilaznus, that someone doesn't normally sleep around for promiscuous reasons. And therefore, if people are living together, so under certain circumstances, we presume that they slept together for the purposes of marriage, and we require a get. So, for example, if a couple is married, and then they get divorced, and then they spend the night with each other, we require a new get. Because we assume that if they spent the night together, they had a pre-existing relationship, and who knows, maybe they made amends, and they were together, and they're planning on renewing their marriage, and therefore we require a get. Now, there's no edim, right? There are no witnesses that they were together, but we say no. Right? The fact that it is known that they were that they spent the night together might be enough to create edus that they had that they were together, and then you can call it kedusha bia, because one of the three ways of getting married is through sexual intimacy, and therefore, since everybody knows that they spend the night together, or people know, doesn't need to be everybody, people know that might qualify at least misafik as edus, and therefore they require a new get.
That chazaka still exists today.
So Moshe Feinstein said, look, that's very nice, right? That's very nice. That's in the time of the Gemara where this was the outlier. But realistically, people who are not getting married, right? They're not getting married. They're halachically, they're getting civilly married. Or they're just living together without marriage at all. they have no intent on.
Is that like a Pelagish situation then?
So according to her motion, no, right? They're just living together, right? They know that Kiddushin is an option, and they didn't take that. And you can't say, right, in the 21st century that people who are living together obviously mean to view this as halachic marriage because they're not going to sleep together outside the confines of marriage. It just isn't true. And therefore, when people are living together, and even if they have civil marriage, and then Rav Moshe Eden, even if they get married through a reform or conservative marriage, he said, as long as they're not getting married with the Orthodox rabbinate, the assumption is that they're not getting married, that they're not planning on having halachic marriage in the full sense of the word. And therefore, we don't have to recognize their marriage, and that's it. And that was Rav Moshe's position. Now, there's a lot of subsections to this, right? Which is, one is you have to say that Enos Adam Osa Bilaso Bilasnos is not true, 21st century. You know, now getting married in a conservative or reform marriage is a different problem, right? Because there, you know, they're not doing bilasnos, right? They're calling it kiddushin, right? So how can Rav Moshe say that that's not marriage? So he said, well, it's like this, right? The halacha is that, right here, well, we'll back up for a second, right? Let's say that you have kiddushei taot, right? That people got married, and then it turns out that the ring was worth less than a shava pruta, right? It was worth 10 cents, right? How you made that mistake, I don't know, but whatever, right? The marriage was toast. The halacha is, then you get married again. What if they get married again? Right, just say that, well, okay, so they made a mistake, but this is a couple, right? Let's say Orthodox couple wanted to be halachically married, right? Why don't you just say, look, at this point, they've obviously been together, right? They have 5 children, right? We know they've been together, there's no question, and they wanted to be halachically married. Why would you say they need new kiddushin at that point? Just say, in Adamosa, Bilas, or Bilas, Nos. They even thought they were married. Why, right? Why do you need a new kiddushin? So the halacha is that you do need a new kiddushin, because it's not enough to be together. In the context of marriage, you need to have a moment where you think you're being together for the purpose of consummating a marriage. But if you think you're already married, then you don't think this act of sexual intimacy is the act of marriage. And what do we assume? That they are together on the assumption that they're already married, and therefore they would never have had in mind that their subsequent, right, being together is an act of marriage. They just think they're married. And therefore, Moshe said, if someone gets married in a conservative or reform ceremony, right, and they think that's kiddushin, and halacha doesn't recognize it for whatever reason, the edim are not valid, take your pick of reasons that we wouldn't recognize it, then none of their subsequent acts of intimacy are going to act as kiddushin because they think they're already married. And therefore, Moshe said, civil marriage is not marriage halachically, because there's no assumption that people are afraid of being intimate with outside the context of halachic marriage. And even someone who got married with another denomination, the fact that they want kiddushin doesn't help you, because they think that they're already married once they leave the, you know, once they leave the hall, once they leave the shul. So then when they're together, they don't think that's affecting marriage. They think they're already married, and therefore Moshe just said, unless you got married within the Orthodox rabbinate, your marriage is not marriage. Period. End of story.
But I've seen, like, conservative shuls here, like, something MS, like, up by, in Thornhill, like, there you had a whole, like, with all the 7 brachas and everything like
correct.
That.
Correct. So
it looked pretty firm to me.
Correct. So one of the problems with Rav Moshe's position is that it's not always true, right? Especially with conservative marriages, right? It was often the case that it was, in fact, halachic marriage, meaning especially old school conservative, where the rabbis were often trained in Orthodox institutions and were relatively traditional. So often what would happen is the rabbi and the cantor would both be Shomer Shabbos, right? Would both basically be halachically observant, and they would be the witnesses, right? So that creates a lot of problems, and to this day, there is this sort of unpublished list that circulates amongst Batei Dinim of which conservative shuls, you know, it's becoming less and less common, but which conservative shuls had observant rabbis and cantors, such that if a couple got married there, you have to worry that their marriage was, even according to most opinions, a halachic marriage. They don't sort of disseminate this list, but there is sort of this list that is around amongst Batei Dinim. For that reason. But the Ramosha's tshuva on paper is that no marriage outside of the Orthodox rabbinate, civil or other denominational, is going to be recognized. Sorry, and I forgot to mention, that's also one of the problems in Israel, right, is that it's the Orthodox rabbinate, right? That's the other sort of big explosion in Israel, is that other denominations want the right to marry people, right? Again, two Jews, all, you know, but they want the right to perform the marriage, have it halakhically recognized, which they're not. You can only get married in the confines of the rabbinate, not just the Orthodox rabbinate, meaning the institutionalized Orthodox rabbinate, meaning the Rabbanut HaReshid LeYisrael. Okay. Yeah?
If someone gets married, let's say, in Canada in a Reformed synagogue and then moves to Israel, their marriage is then recognized
civilly. Civilly,
so
correct.
Not religiously.
Well, so we'll come to that in just a second.
Sorry.
The other position, no, not sorry, you don't have to be sorry, but that's the next, next issue, right, is, so the person who argued on this was Rav Henkin, right? Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who was the posek in America before Rav Moshe, remained influential even after Moshe came, but was sort of, I don't know, demoted to second place posek or something in America. I don't know if that's fair, but that was like, that's practically what happened, was Rav Moshe became the most prominent posek in America, but before that it was Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. You know, again, this is not a statement of who was a better posek. This is just a statement of reality. Rav Moshe became more influential. You know, I think Adam Mintz has an article like about Rav Henkin called like the forgotten posek of America or something. Like most people just don't know. Now, there's a good reason for that, right? Which is that if you try to read his tshuvot, it's impossible. Like Rav Moshe writes short, and you know, is it
in English?
Yeah, practically in English, exactly. Rav Henkin, his writing is beyond dense. So Rav Henkin felt it's not true. He said that civil marriage is marriage. Period. End of story. Because, he said, people who are living together, they don't view it as promiscuous, right? You know, definitely not in the 50s, right? Even if they're living together in common law marriage, even common law marriage, right? Forget civil marriage. So it's civil marriage for sure. Right, if a couple goes to the court and gets a marriage, they don't think this is promiscuous. They think it's marriage. Right? That's what they're calling it. Right, and when they, you know, go home, you know, the first night and they get married, they, even if they were living together before, you know, what do they call? Right, what do they? You know, there is this notion of consummating a marriage. Right, even if they've slept together before, there is this notion that that first night, right, their, you know, their honeymoon, right, there's something different about that. And Ein Adam Boze Bilazo Bilaznos. And you know what? They are planning to get married. And he said, even common law marriage, forget civil marriage, common law marriage.
But
right? If people move in together.
Anything, like, they're just like that. It's after moving in together for like 2 or 3 years that you're a commonly.
Right. So he said, even that. He said, it doesn't matter because if people were living together, at some point you have, right? Everyone knows that they're a couple, they're a thing, right? He said, that is halachically marriage. That is. Kiddushei Bia, right? There is a presumption that they live together and that they live together even if not for marriage because they want to be together as a couple. And he said, that's enough. And therefore, he said, even if they didn't get halachically married, they're going to need a get.
Do you think he would still say that now?
I don't know. I don't know. Because there is a caveat in his tshuva, which is important. But first, just to articulate his position, and therefore he said that anyone who civil marriage, common law marriage, will need a get at the end of their marriage. Now, how do poskim divide on this? So most poskim will tell you that lechadchila, right? If we can, we'll be machmer for Rav Henkin. Right. So if someone got married in a conservative marriage or a foreign marriage, a civil marriage, and now they're becoming more traditional and they want a get, right? If both sides are amenable to a get. So then we will say, get a get l'chumra. Right? Definitely, if someone had a conservative or reform marriage, we will say, get a get l'chumra. Right? And even civil marriage, if we can get them to get a get, then we will do that. B'di'eved, right, let's say, which will sometimes happen, the husband, you know, they got married in a civil marriage. Then the woman decides she wants to become more, you know, more religious, and she becomes Orthodox. And the husband is still secular, and he doesn't want to give a get. He said, well, I never got married religiously, we already got divorced, we went to the courts, right? We've settled everything, why should I give a get? So b'makom igun, right, where the only choice... So then most poskim will paskin b'di'eved like Rav Moshe and say, right, so mikra din, most poskim paskin like Rav Moshe Feinstein, but l'chatchila, we're so scared of adultery and mamzerus, so we will always try to get a get if possible. If there was any sort of union, we always try to do that. So, coming back to Israel for a moment, the rabbinate, in general, even if someone's married outside of Israel, will try to get a get, even on a civil marriage, because the tradition of poskim is to try to be machmir for Rav Henkin. Even though, again, it's not just Ramoshe. Ramoshe poskim that way, Shmuel Zalman Orbach poskim that way, the Tzitzeliezer poskim that way, Rav Avadya Yosef poskim that way. It's not like, right, the majority, right, Rubo Kikulo of the poskim think that civil marriage is not halachic marriage, but we are always machmir for Rav Henkin. So if someone got married outside of the country, so then we'll always try, even if they had civil marriage, to get a get. And for sure, let's say someone got married with a Orthodox rabbinate outside of the country, right? Even if they never file it when they get to Israel, if they want to get divorced, the rabbinate is going to want them to get a get, because even if they've never registered with the country, if they want a divorce, they are halachically married. There's good reason to believe they're halachically married. So the first question you even have to ask is, if we should introduce civil marriage in Israel, is, well, is civil marriage marriage, right? Are we just going to create headaches for ourselves by creating civil marriage? Because it may be that, at least according to Rav Henkin, we're creating a nightmare. And the other nightmare is that, let's say, create civil marriage. You might not just have civil marriage. You might have even worse than civil marriage. You might have people who register with the state civilly, but get married with an unrecognized rabbinate. That would be really bad, because then their marriage is almost definitely going to be kiddushin, right? And then they're really going to need a get, but they're only civilly married by the state, so the state would have no recourse to force them to get a get if they wanted to remarry, and then you're creating real halachic problems, right? So there's all types of things that we can open up.
Have the cohabitation agreement, so isn't that still like a civil marriage thing according to Rav Henkin?
Possibly, right? And that, so, right, the problem is that if you really poskim under Rav Henkin, then yes, even the domestic union partnership agreements may create halachic problems. You're only advancing this problem. Because in Israel, what do you have realistically nowadays? You have who gets married civilly in Israel, right? So either people who halachically can't get married, or people who are anti-religion. But there's a good number of traditional people in Israel, you know, especially Sephardim, right? Who, like, Sephardi Chilonim, who, like, have no interest in keeping halacha, but, like, you know, certain things they do, like Bris Milah, and they want, you know, they want a chuppah at their marriage, they want a rabbi at their marriage, right? They're not, you know, so, like, they don't want a domestic partnership agreement, they want to get married, right? Even if they lived together before the marriage, at some point they're going to say, we want to get married, and they're going to want a rabbi there, and even though they have no intention in keeping halacha afterwards, they're going to get married, and therefore they're going to need, right? Again, so that, you know, a lot of people who don't care about religion too much still get halachically married, right? That, you know, it's not like everybody who's secular gets a domestic partnership agreement, right? A lot of them just want to get married, and they don't care too much to get the rabbinate, even if it's annoying. So, right, one question you're obviously going to have to ask is, are we going to solve problems with civil marriage? And that depends on Rav Henkin, the Rav Henkin Rav Moshe dispute. But let's say we poskened like Rav Moshe, totally, right? We would say civil marriage is not marriage at all. Why would somebody be opposed to introducing as an avenue civil marriage in Israel, right? Why would someone not want to do that?
It's a Jewish state.
There's so one is, so this is, right, so this is what I mentioned before is, right, the religious Zionist argument is it's a Jewish state. And part of the, you know, the messianic vision of religious Zionism, right, especially if you're more of the, you know, if you're a follower of Rav Kook, is that the Rabbanut has the potential to be some precursor to the Sanhedrin, and the state is Reshit Smichat Gulateinu, and therefore, what are you doing, right? We didn't manage to create a full-out theocracy in 1948, but hey, at least marriage is under the auspices of the state. You want to chip away at the little halachic influence you have on the state, right? Where is our image of Reshit Smichat Gulateinu, of God's presence being the Torah aspect of the state, right? If you are a diehard religious Zionist, and especially if you're in any way, sense or in any way, shape, or form a messianic Zionist, right? Giving up on marriage for the state is just going to rub you the wrong way, right? You're just going to say, I can't do that. Good, that's one reason. Why else?
Well, given everything you said about, like, Rav Moshe and then Rav Hinkin, like, you have the possibility of creating Mamzerim.
Right, so one right, then the second one is, okay, maybe we're just not convinced by Rav Moshe, right? Right, at some level, we're just, right? Again, our tradition is to be Machmir, not like Rav Moshe. You know, so you right now, under this current circumstance, we minimize the amount we need to rely on Rav Moshe Feinstein, because most people who don't care enough to go get married in Cyprus will get married under the Rabbanut, will get divorced under the Rabbanut. They may hate it, they may kick and scream, but whatever, they're going to do it. So we're going to prevent Mamzerim, we're going to prevent halachic adultery, right? Whatever, that's a good thing. What else?
You might be promoting...
What?
The Haredim. Losing
their right, so right, there's the political thing, right, which is obviously if you happen to be in control of the revenant, the more power you have, the better for you as a bargaining tool. That's for sure. So there are political reasons for it.
Would it promote homosexuality then too?
So probably not, right? Meaning, because the fact is that they can get a domestic partnership union, right? Maybe, and we'll see that some people are concerned about this. Is that, you know, halacha, you know, then you're forced to have the state recognize not just forbidden marriages, but you know, to recognize as marriage homosexual unions, which you might think is a particularly hard thing to do ideologically, right? Even if you don't want a halachic state, you might not want. And we'll see, there are people concerned about that possibility. What else?
Is it legitimizing promiscuity?
Right. So Rav Stav pushes this one. Rav Stav says, look, there's a problem here, and now what you just said, you're legitimizing promiscuity. Now there's about five or six different things that could go under that. So let's go through let's put that more halachically, right? Why do I care that I'm legitimating promiscuity?
We're saying that there can be sexual interactions that are not under
Okay, so you're focusing on the marriage one. So this is actually what Rav Stav does, right? Rav Stav, if you skip here to. Where did I do it?
14.
Here. To 13. To 13. Go to 13 first. Right? Rav says like as follows. Look at the Rambam. This is the Rambam in the beginning of Hilchos Ishus. The Rambam says as follows. Kodem instead, right? Normally the Rambam just gives you sort of halacha, right? The Rambam writes halachic code. But in Hilchos Ishus, when talking about marriage, he says, Kodem matan tara haya adam pogea isha bashuk. In ratzahu vihi lisa ota machnisa letoch beito voala beino levein atzmo v'tiel elisha. Right before the Torah, if a man met a woman in the marketplace and they wanted to marry each other, you'd bring her home and they would, right, consummate the marriage privately and they'd be married. That's it. Kevan shenitna Torah, nistavu Yisrael. Shem yirtze ha'ish lisa isha, yikneo ta tchila b'fnei edim, achakach tiyel isha. But once the Torah was given, so Jews were commanded that if a man wants to marry a woman, so then first you need to perform kiddushin in front of witnesses, and then they'll be married. Shenemar ki yikach ish isha uvayla. So Rav Stav says, why does the Rambam start kiddushin, the laws of marriage, with a history lesson? So he suggests, well, marriage is different. It's not just another halacha, it is it's one of those halachot, right? There are certain halachot that are definitional to what it means to be Jewish. Like, that when the Torah was given, we changed the way we live together. We forge relationships. Right, the Meiri has a much more expanded version of this in his Hakdama to Kiddushin. And he says, one of the big additions of the Torah was that it took common law marriage and it transformed it into Kiddushin. Now, how did it do that? He said, literally every part of marriage is sanctified by obligation and responsibility. Right? Common law marriage doesn't carry with it inherent responsibilities and obligations, but kiddushin does. It carries with it criminal consequences for violation of marriage. I mean, it carries with it, right, the death penalty for adultery. it carries with it financial obligations, right? Because now the husband has to provide it for his wife. It provides a context for procreation. It provides implications in terms of vows. It provides implications in terms of what happens if the husband dies without children. It provides a mechanism of yibum for the husband's legacy to be taken care of, for the woman to be, yibum is really two ways, right? It provides a mechanism for the husband's legacy to be taken care of by the wife marrying the brother-in-law and having a child who will be the spiritual heir of the husband, but it also provides a obligation on the family of the husband to take care of the wife even after the death of the husband, right? They can't just abandon her. They need to choose to abandon her, right? The brothers need to give chalitza, because until they do, she is married to the family, right? She has zika. She's married to all brothers, right? So we've sanctified union through, right, through kiddushin and all of its implications. And therefore, Rav Stav feels very strongly. Rav Stav is famous in Israel, or infamous in Israel, depending on who you ask, because he wanted to be chief rabbi. Now, Rav Stav says, why did I want to be chief rabbi? I know that the chief rabbinate is flawed. Why don't I push for the chief rabbinate to be dissolved? So Rav Stav says, no, I believe in the chief rabbinate with all its flaws. One of the reasons is because he thinks that marriage is the halacha. Right? It's one of those things that defines us as a Jewish people. And giving up on halachic marriage in the state is not just like allowing people to eat not kosher in their homes. It's giving up on a fundamental value of what it means to be Jewish. And Rav Stav, you look at 14, believes in this so much that he says, David Stav, a modern Orthodox rabbi who heads the Star Organization of Rabbis, speaks out harshly against the possibility of non-rabbinate-sanctioned private weddings. The moment there is a rabbi who conducts such private ceremonies, I think it is proper to ban him and divest him of his rabbinic capacity. Right? This is Rav Stav, right, who opposed the current rabbinate, but he thinks very strongly that if someone performs a marriage outside of the Rabbanut HaRashit, they should be stripped of their title. Right? And the he even helped push forward a law. What is, if someone, an Orthodox rabbi, let's say, performs kiddushin outside of the confines of marriage, right? What are the consequences, potentially? A 2-year prison sentence, right? And something like, I forget, $500,000 fine or something absurd, right? Some tremendous financial liability. That wasn't pushed by the Haredi community. That was pushed by Tzohar. And that was pushed by Tzohar, and he said, personally, I would even report such a rabbi to the police, because a rabbi like that causes the proliferation of mamzerim, right, and creates anarchy. And I've personally been approached by 5 to 10 couples who asked for such weddings, and I threw them out. Right, this is a moderate speaking, and the reason he says this, right, I'm not guessing, right, I listened to an hour and a half panel, you can go online, there's an hour and a half panel with Rav Stav, with Shlomo Brody, and with Seth Farber on civil marriage in Israel, and he says, right, this is why I care so much, right, because marriage is unique. And then he goes farther, and this, I give him credit for saying this, right, a lot of people are sort of Pollyannish about this, and they say that if only the rabbinate were nice, if only the rabbinate were nice, then no one would hate the rabbinate in Israel, right? Rav Stav says, I'm not going to pretend. I know that bureaucracy, by definition, has problems, and everyone hates bureaucracy. And I know that even if I became the chief rabbi and I was nice and we tried to fix problems, people would still hate me because I am an institutionalized rabbi. Right? I'm not pretending that that's going to go away, but I'm willing to pay that price because I think it's important that marriage stay under the auspices of the rabbinate. Right? He said, I'm not pretending. I've made a cost-benefit analysis, and this, I think, that cost, I think, is worth it, because it is this important. And if you look in 15, it's so, right, he goes farther, right, not just him, but Elie Fischer notes that there are Orthodox rabbis on the liberal end of the Orthodox spectrum, like Rav Shai Piron, Benny Lau, Shlomo Riske, and Seth Farber, and as we'll see, even people on the Chardal, on the more, you know, not Haredi, but right wing of religious Zionist community, like Riv Malamud, who endorsed civil marriage, Even Rav Bakshi Daron, who was really from the Haredi establishment, who was the former chief rabbi, of Israel, look at the second paragraph in 15, he stated at Tzohar conference that the time had come to end the chief rabbinate's monopoly on personal status issues, as the position only generates antipathy and does not really stop individuals from living their lives as they see fit. The Tzohar organization immediately dissociated itself from Rav Bakshi Daron's statements. Right? Tzohar, again, the liberal rabbinic organization in Israel, could not accept a quasi-Haredi rabbi coming in and say, we should have civil marriage, and they never invited him back. And they dissociated themselves from the statements because they don't believe this. Okay, what else? Right, that's marriage. But even not marriage, right? There's sort of broader concerns. Why else would you not endorse civil marriage? Don't overthink it. Just throw out terms that you've heard, like catchphrases, but they're true, right? Okay, I'll do them. All right, look at the beginning, right? First page. Tochecha. All right, there's a general obligation to give rebuke, right? To tell people to do the right thing in halacha, right? It's a pasuk. Lo tisna lachicha b'vecha, ocheach tochecha namidecha, lo tisa alav chet. Right? Don't hate your brother in your heart. Rebuke your friend and do not bear sin for him. Right? There's a biblical mitzvah of rebuke. So giving up on it is giving up on a means by which we push people to do mitzvah. Right? Plain and simple. Right, Lifnei Iver, I probably put Lifnei Iver here also, right, Lifnei Iver, right, or Arevut, right, all these related mitzvot, right, I gave you in six here, right, just Arevut, right, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebavet, right, right, Hanista, right, look at the Gemara, right, Hanistarot, La Hashem Elokeinu V'Nigel Lanu V'Nigel Lanu V'Olam, right, the hidden things are to God, but revealed things are for us and our children forever, Lama Nakud Al Lanu L'Vaneinu V'Al Ayin Shebeid. So why are there dots on top of the on some of the letters? So the Gemara says, "Malamed shelo anash al nistarot, achav Yisrael at Yarden, divrei Rabbi Huda." We weren't punished for hidden mitzvot until we crossed over the Yarden. But Amar le Nechemya chenach al nistarot olam. Are we ever punished for private sins? Velo kvar nemar ad olam. We're never punished for things that are private. Elak shem shelo anash al nistarot, kach lo anash al onshin shebegaloi, achav Yisrael at Yarden. Right, so Rabbi Nechemya concludes that we were only became responsible for other people when we crossed the Yarden for public mitzvot. But everyone agrees, right? Rabbi Nechemya interviewed that public mitzvot, we are responsible. If someone else violates an aveira or doesn't perform a mitzvah, that is our problem. Or, as the Gemara calls it in Shavuot, the kol aveira shebatara mikol olam lo, right? Does God not punish the community for sins, right, of others? Vakziv, v'kishlu ish ba'achiv, right? One will stumble because his brother sins. Ish bavon achiv. You are punished for your brother's sins. Melamed shekol Yisrael arevim zebazeh. Right? We love this statement, right? We're all responsible for others. But what it means is we're responsible that other people should perform mitzvot. Right? There's a nice element to this. Namely, like, I can perform your mitzvah for you. I can say Kiddush, and everyone can say Amen and fulfill their mitzvah because of me, right? Things like that. But there's also an obligation there, and the Gemara says, "Hatam sheish biado limchot v'lamichu." Well, the classic case is if you could have protested and you did not, right? Then you are punished for not encouraging other people to do mitzvot. So, regardless of what you think should have happened, we now have an institution by which most people in Israel who can be halachically married are halachically married. Right? Not everybody, but if you removed religious marriage, what would happen? All the people who just sort of don't care too much, but just go through religious marriage because it's just easier than the alternative, right? Than trying to fly to Cyprus or, you know, get a domestic partnership union and then fill in the gaps that it doesn't cover, right? The rights that it doesn't cover with separate agreements. Just get a rabbi from the rabbanut to marry you, file, and then you get all rights of marriage and all implications, right? So, but you are giving up on that, right? You now have the ability to encourage people to do mitzvot. What are you doing giving up on it? If you skip down to 3, so it's source 10 here. It's not just that we encourage people to do mitzvot. Bezdin has the option of coercion. And right, there is a principle of al mitzvot aseh, right, this is number 10. By positive mitzvot, like someone who we say to him, make a sukkah, live in a sukkah, and he doesn't do it, lulav ein oseh. Take your lulav and he doesn't do it, what's the halacha? Makinoto, achetei tzei nafsho. We can beat him either until he dies or until almost he dies, right? To machloket rishonim, whether ad is ad v'chal v'ad v'lo ad v'chal, right? Meaning up to and including his death or not. But a court can coerce someone to perform a positive mitzvah.
Isn't that a question, though, about marriage? Like, what does ki kach, if it, that means if or...
Right, so it's a machlok is whether it is a positive mitzvah to get married or only a mitzvah kiyumit, yeah. Right? But everyone agrees that if you're going to be together, right?
Right.
So then it is a mitzvah to be married, right? Whether there's an active mitzvah for you to get married, right, is a machloket, right?
Together.
Correct, right? The Rambam in, right, Aleph, and Elos, Ishus, and Mitzvah Resh Chav Bet in Sefer HaMitzvah thinks it is a positive mitzvah to get married, right? The Rush famously does not in Perek Aleph, Perek Yud, Halacha Yud Bet of Ksuvos. Yes, right? But everyone agrees that if you are going to be together, then you should do it in the context of marriage. And it's possible, though not clear, that there may be a prohibition of being together outside the confines of marriage. It might be a prohibition of lo tiyeh kedeshah, right? Might not be, right? The exact contours of that mitzvah or that prohibition are a bit complicated. But it's not just that, right, again, it's not just that we encourage people to do mitzvah, we can coerce them. Now, there is a machloket between the ketzot and netivot, right, who are the two main commentaries on Choshen Mishpat, on the monetary section of Shulchan Aruch in Siman Gimel, right towards the beginning, of whether the principle of coercion towards mitzvot is only under the auspices of a formal Beit Din or not. The ketzot thinks yes, the netivot thinks no. Right, he thinks that this is true of the average person on the street. Right, you see someone who doesn't want to take a lulav, you have the right to slap him until he does. Right, that is the position of the nesivos. Whether we paskin like that or not, again, I'm not going to weigh in on that. But Professor Eliav Shochtman notes in number 12 that even the nesivos. I just felt I can't say the nesivot in yeshivish. Right, the nesivos. Right, no one. No one calls him that. I'm sure Svardim do, but I'm sure he didn't call himself that. Professor Shochtman notes in number 12 that when the Nesivo says that only a Bezdin, sorry, when the Ketzot says, rather, that only a Bezdin can coerce mitzvot, he said that can mean one of two things. You can either think that means that a Bezdin, like a formal Bezdin of rabbis, needs to be in charge in order to coerce mitzvot, but it could also mean that an individual can't coerce mitzvot, but any recognized authority can. Right? I mean, the Ketzot may not mean that only a bezni, may mean a, right? It's not a private affair, it's a public affair. Right? The community can coerce mitzvot through its public institutions. But if you think it means that, there's a good reason to believe that even if the chief rabbinate isn't a formal bezdin, it is a bezdin for the purposes of coercion of mitzvot. So you look at number 12, right? He writes as follows: Achein im magamara chakika rak lehitarev ba'orach chayav v'padim shel adam domeh shiraui lekayem et horatem shel chachmei Yisrael shenizkru leil. If the goal of the legislation is only to interfere with people's private lives, it seems appropriate to follow the instruction of the sages mentioned above, right? Shikavu shima kfiya alla larchik yudim milakem et vod arei shedavar pasul biram. He said, so if it's going to, right, drive people away, maybe you shouldn't do it. But he says, the purpose of the coercion is to give a Jewish flavor to this state. There's nothing invalid about that. Not halachically, nor legally. And and the Jewish nature of the state of Israel is, right, tied up in our Declaration of Independence, where we said Israel is a Jewish state. And it's part of the basic laws of the state. It's part of the definition of Israel is to make it, at some level, Jewish, and some level, halachic. So, Professor Shochman says that, according to the Ketzot, even according to the Ketzot, you might argue that since the point of the rabbinate, it's not just like the rabbinate happens to do this, right, part of the status quo agreement was to allow for halacha to be integrated into the definition of the state, that is a Beis Din. They are functioning in that role. So those who push against civil marriage, they can, from a halachic perspective, either say, well, look, practically we have control over marriage, and therefore it allows us to fulfill all our different mitzvot of tochacha and arvud, right, our responsibility for others' permanent mitzvot. It's under, yes, it's coercive, but we're allowed to be coercive, either because everyone can be coercive, like the nesivos, or even if you think like those who need a Beis Din, maybe for these purposes, the rabbinate is a Beis Din, and therefore it's a good thing that it's coercive, right? That's actually something halacha endorses. Or, like Reb Stav, even if I don't want that in general, Kiddushin might be different, it might be definitional to who we are, and therefore I would push, right, he would push for having marriage under the auspices of halacha, even if with other things he'd be willing to give up on it. So therefore you have many rabbis in Israel who say they're not willing to entertain the notion of giving up wholesale on halacha, a organized chief rabbinate, right, controlled kiddushin, because, right, of tochacha, because of marriage, and in the negative, to prevent mamzerut, because you run the risk of Rav Henkin situations where possibly, right, people who will get married civilly would then not be under the auspices of the court for the purpose of divorce, which, at least according to Rav Henkin, still creates marriage and divorce problems, and therefore mamzerut problems, and you don't want to give up on that either. On the other side of the equation, why would you encourage, let's go through each of those arguments. Why would you say, even from an Orthodox perspective, right, a halachic perspective, why would you encourage civil marriage in Israel? Let's now do the flip side.
Less mamzerut.
Okay, so possibly less mamzerut, right? Because you could say, look, right now what happens sometimes is that people will get married in Kiddushin, and you know what, maybe they'll just commit adultery, right? You know, okay, eventually they'll get around to a get, but they'll be separated for a while, and, you know, they don't view themselves as together, even if halachically they are. It could prevent certain mamzer cases, right? So maybe it's a balance, right? Maybe.
Well, like someone from Chabad said, like the reason Chabad doesn't push for like halachic marriages, because then they don't need to worry about pushing for halachic divorce.
Right, so that might be true. Now, what about the Rav Henkin problem? So how would you respond to the Rav Henkin problem? Right.
Go by motion.
Right. So one is to say, well, we don't really paskin like Rav Henkin, right? Right. No, really. Right. One is to say, look, when we only machmir for Rav Henkin, but really we paskin like Rav Moshe, that civil marriage isn't halachically marriage. Right. There's another possibility, and this is actually very clever. So, as I mentioned, Rav Henkin is very hard to read. Very hard to read. So I remember when I gave shir in Colombia for a year. At the Hillel. So one of the shirim I gave was on the Machlokes of Moshe and Rav Henkin, civil marriage. I asked amongst the Rosh Yeshiva, where can I find like a copy of Rav Henkin? Right? It's not like a sefer that everybody has. Now, of the Rosh Yeshiva, only three that I spoke to had ever read Rav Henkin. Most people had read Rav Moshe's Tshuva, where he summarizes Rav Henkin. When I found Rav Henkin's Tshuva, I realized why. Rav Moshe's Tshuva is, let's say, 5-6 pages long. It's hard, but like, whatever, it's 5-6 pages long. Rav Henkin's Tshuva is over 100 pages of the densest argumentation I've ever read in my life. It took me 3 weeks to, I mean, I read in my free time, but still, it took me like 3 weeks to get through it. Impossibly difficult. And he has four long essays in the first volume of his Sefer, but then at the end he has a fifth chapter on the topic, which I lucked, it was lucky. When I was looking it up, one of the people I asked who I was sure had read Rav Henkin inside was Rabbi Yonah Ries, who at the time was the dean of Ritz, of, you know, the rabbinical school in YU, but also had been the director of the Beis Din, Beis Din of America. So I knew if anyone had read it, he had read it, which, of course, he had read it, and he happened to have been looking for the books by Rav Henkin in the library, because they had a case that hung on Rav Moshe and Rav Henkin in the Beis Din at the time, and he wanted it so he could quote something, right? He was writing the policy paper, he was writing the decision for the court, he wanted Rav Henkin. He told me, you should look, there's a fifth piece, right? Once you finish that, the last piece is that Rav Henkin had an exception. Henkin felt that Russian Jews who got married in Soviet Russia, who were, you know, not religious, who didn't want to be religious, right, who were proud communists, Their civil marriage would not be kiddushin. Why? Because communists, proud communists, were known to be anti-religious. And therefore, when they got married civilly, it wasn't because they couldn't get married halachically or they didn't care to get married halachically. It was because they believed that religion was the opium of the masses and that they didn't believe in kiddushin. Everybody knew that it was ideological. They did not believe in kiddushin. Therefore, if Henkin said, if you articulate or it is known that you don't believe in marriage, then everyone will agree that civil marriage doesn't. So that was the case that was in the Bezdin. It was two people who'd been married in Soviet Russia. So Seth Farber, who runs E-Team and endorses, who wants civil marriage to exist in Israel, said, here's your solution to that problem. Even no one passing like Rav Moshe, even Rav Henkin has an out clause, which is, if it is explicit that your civil marriage is not halachic marriage, then he'll say it's not marriage. So he said it's very simple. Add a clause to the civil marriage law, which is, if you choose not to go through the rabbinate, and you choose to get civilly married, one of the things you have to sign when you go in is, I'm getting civilly married to the exclusion of halachic marriage. And then, like that, everyone will agree, Rav Moshe and Rav Henkin, that that's not halachic marriage, you're done. Right? Which was very clever. That's very clever, because according to Rav Henkin, that would solve that problem. Now, what about these secondary problems, right? That's the biggest halachic hurdle.
Yeah, but people might say that they don't believe in it, but in reality they do.
So that doesn't matter. Okay. No, I mean, it's not whether you believe in it, but you say that this is not, right?
Oh.
This is not, right? Say this isn't, right? Meaning, right, once Rav Henkin says it's possible to create civil marriage which isn't halachic marriage by making clear that you don't want it to be halachic marriage, so if you verbalize it, so then you're fine. And even if in the back of your mind you're saying, nah, I want it to be halachic marriage, right, it doesn't matter. In halacha we paskin, dvarim shebaleivinim, dvarim. Anything that's in your head, if you don't articulate it, doesn't matter. So if you say, I am not getting halachically married, you can in your head think whatever you want, right, it doesn't matter. You're not halachically married. For halachic purposes, we only care what you, especially transactional issues, right, we only care what you say, not what you think, right? So just make them say, this is civil marriage and not halachic marriage, and there, then everyone agrees, you don't need to get. Before we go to the next issue, how else could you solve this problem? You could have civil marriage and halachic divorce, right? You could come up with a compromise and say, because of all the complications with Gittin, we're not going to take divorce away from the rabbinate, but we will take marriage away from the rabbinate, right? Now, this was the position that was taken by Rav Yaakov Maidan and Ruth Gavison. So you've done Tikva, so maybe you've heard of this, the Gavison Maidan.
Yeah,
okay. Okay, right, so you tell me, right? What is the Gavison Maidan covenant?
Professor Gavison is she's Chiloni, yeah.
Yes.
Professor in Israel, and Rav Maidan is a Rosh Yeshiva at Gush, and they came together and decided that they were going to make this crazy agreement to somehow allow, like, there to be religion within, to allow there to be religion still in the state of Israel, but that there were certain limitations. Like, one of the big things was that if there's a majority, city that is not Shomer Shabbat, then you won't implement all the rules about being Shomer Shabbat on the city.
Right. So basically, Maidan and Ruth Gavison got together and said, look, there's too much animosity between the religious and not religious in Israel. Let's come together and have dialogue and come to some sort of compromise. So they created this text, which the summary of which, right? They have a document called the summary, right, of the Gavison Maidan covenant, which is itself like 116 pages. But whatever, it's like this all-encompassing thing. Is their suggestions for kashrus in Israel and Shabbos observance in Israel, etc. One of the big things is marriage. Now their compromise was actually this: was to take marriage away from the rabbinate, but leave divorce with it. And if you look at here, look at 17. A basic law will be this was their suggestion. A basic law will be promulgated in the following effect. Every person has the right to establish a family. Specific provisions to that effect will be anchored in law. Only those persons who have received a marriage license from the state are eligible for marriage. I want to come back to the question of homosexuality in a minute, so let's skip that. Go to 7, right? It was clause 7, right? I just gave you different clauses, but 7 over here in 17, right? So the third paragraph. Dissolution of marriages will be conducted by civil and rabbinic courts. A civil court is permitted to condition a civil dissolution on the prior conclusion of the marriage according to religious law, including with clause 2. And if you skip down then to Professor Gavinson, she says, divorce according to Jewish law, concerning the welfare of the child and concerns regarding a schism in the nation. The coda to clause 2 states that a person will be considered single only if he's also considered single according to religious law. This is not an easy coda for the free-thinking public and even for a portion of the observant. There are those who claim it's actually worse than the status quo on this issue. Right, meaning, right, Ruth Gavin says, who's Chiloni, right? She says, why did I agree to say marriage should be taken from the rabbinate and divorce left, right? Many people say this is bad, and some say it's even worse, right? Meaning now, at least people know they're getting into religious marriage, right? Why would I endorse having a situation where people think they're getting out of the rabbinate and then they want to get divorced, and surprise, you still can only get a divorce through, right? Why would I endorse that as someone who doesn't believe in religion? So she says, despite these concerns, I stand behind the agreement. First, the secular public must understand that the requirement for divorce, according to Orthodox Halacha, is critical for the religiously observant. Without this requirement, there would be no alternative to maintaining independent genealogical records. We can reasonably assume that if independent records were instituted, no agreement would be reached to eliminate the Orthodox monopoly. Second, the proposed arrangement is needed to protect the best interests of the child. Only this arrangement guarantees that a woman defined as already married by Jewish law will not remarry. A child born to a woman whose previous marriage had not yet been dissolved as a mamzer, a bastard, according to Jewish law. And the halachic status of a bastard deals a mortal blow to the child's basic right to marry, while stigmatizing him in the eyes of the wider Israeli religious community. Third, and perhaps most important, is the fear of dividing the nation. From my perspective, the reason for requiring religious divorce is not religious per se, but a cultural national one. She said, look, the reason she would agree is because, basically, the stakes of divorce are higher than the stakes of marriage. If people live together without kiddushin, so the stakes are not so high, right? Maybe they're violating Lotia Kadesha, maybe they're not, but the possibility, even the far-off possibility that this child will one day become religious and will want to get married to an Orthodox person who cares about Mamzerut, that's a problem if you believe in, you know, as I heard her say it, right? She said, if you believe in, right, freedom, you've got to believe in the freedom of your child to do what they want, including become religious. Right? And if your child wants to become religious, and anybody's going to think the child is a mamzer, right? You are creating a situation of a broken unity in the Jewish people. And she said she's willing to pay the price, even as someone who doesn't believe in it, to maintain, right, unity in the Jewish people. So, right. So if you wanted to push back, you could either give in and say, like Ruth Gavison, I'm willing to say, okay, marriage will be taken away from the chief rabbinate, but not divorce. Or you could say, like, right, Seth Farber, put in a clause, right? Or just say Paschal like Ramosha, and then there is no problem. Okay. Now what about the other concerns? What about the tochacha and coercion concerns, right? Don't we have an obligation to other people to encourage them to do mitzvot? So how would you respond to that?
There's a chance that if we have a Beit Din like shoving things down their throat, that they might actually be turned off from
mitzvot. Exactly. Together. Right. So you look at number 8. The Gemara in Yevamot has a right, very important principle. Amar Rabbi La Mishum Rabbi Elazar Bar Shimon. Kishem Shemitzvah LaAdam Lomar Davar Anishma. Kach Mitzvah LaAdam Shlo Lomar Davar Sheino Nishma. Just like you have a commandment to say things that will be heard, you have a commandment to avoid saying things that will not be heard. Right? We're not stupid, right? Halacha says if someone's not going to listen to you and it's just going to be counterproductive, don't do it.
What's the context of that?
What?
What's the context right. In the Gemara? Like, why are they talking about that?
In the context of right, different things, right? This same sugya discusses when you're allowed to lie for peace. It discusses some of the laws of rebuke, right? It's all the different exceptions to our speech ethics, right? So Rabbi Abba Omer Chova, he says, it's not just a good idea. He says, it's an obligation, right? It's a pasuk in Mishlei. Al tochach letz pen yisnecha hochech lachacham v'yavecha. Right? Don't rebuke a scorner lest he hate you. Right? And rebuke a wise man and he will love you. Right? The Gemara is not stupid. The Gemara says, don't be an idiot. Right? Don't do things that are counterproductive. Or, even more strikingly, the Rashba, number 9, has the following claim. He said, right, the Gemara has all types of cases when you're not supposed to give tochacha. But then there are cases where if you follow the Gemara, technically, you are supposed to rebuke somebody. Right? So the Rashba said, but what happens if you come across a situation where following the technical rules in the Gemara would say that this is a case when you should run the risk of somebody hating you and you should give rebuke, but you just know in your gut that that's a bad idea, right? What do you do, right? It's formal halacha versus bad idea. What do you do? So the Rashba puts the following principle, and he says, da, ki lashon racha tishbor garem, right? Sometimes a soft tongue can break bones. And kfar yadata mashekatuv bin nazir gdola avir lishma mi mitzvah shelo lishma. You know that sometimes a sin for the right reasons is better than a mitzvah for the wrong reasons. Kol shekein anu. So for sure in our case, she'ein banu koach midin torah ledin binin vecho. We don't live in a generation where we have capital, we have the power to run capital law. Av lo bedine knasot, and we can't run fines. Lo tzarach shal, only if necessary. Lo lavor al divrei Torah lasot siag la Torah, and not to violate Torah, but to protect it. V'mashtika litim legeder ... Sometimes silence is offense, so do it. Right, Rav Amital has a chapter on this in his Sefer Rishisi Tal, and he said, the Rashba should guard our lives, that especially when it comes to rebuke and forcing people to do mitzvot, don't follow the letter of the law. Right? Sometimes you've just got to have a head on your shoulders and call it what you want. Say it's an exception. Say it's an avir lishma. I don't care what you say. The Rashba already told you, don't be an idiot. Right? Don't force things down people's throats if it's going to be counterproductive. So one of the big arguments people say is, look, the rabbinate creates a lot of animosity and just drives people away from religion. And don't tell me formal, don't give me all these formal things, right? Tochacha, arvus, or even kiddushin is the, you know, sanctity of the Jewish people. Like, at some point, wake up and say it's being counterproductive. And just say, cut our losses, and you know what? Forget it. It's just, it's driving people away from religion. It's not worth our time. Right, so that's sort of the response. Right, this Rashba, right? Rami Tal said this Rashba should control our lives. Right, Rav Shlomo Zalman has a famous tshuva, Chelagalav Tshuva Lamed Hey, where he says, right, for example, well, coming back, we mentioned Lifnei Iver before, right? He said the Gemara says because of Lifnei Iver, you're not supposed to, at least as Nifsal Shulchan Aruch, you're not supposed to give food to somebody who's not going to make a bracha. Rav Shlomo Zalman says nowadays it's not just that you can, but you must. Because if somebody not religious comes to your house and you say, oh, I'm not giving you a couple, you know, it's 105 degrees outside, say, I'm not giving you water because you're not going to make a bracha, right? Or someone who's going to resent it, you say, well, I'll give you the water, but you have to say amen. So my bracha, he said, that's a worse lifnei iver. Because it's a lifnei iver, right now the person has, you know, a warm, fuzzy relationship with Torah Jews. He's just not personally observant. You start forcing it down their throat, they're going to hate Orthodox Judaism, and it's just going to be worse. He said, the same principle that used to say, don't give them that cup of water if they're not going to make a bracha, tells you now, do it. Right? Lifnei iver is a double-edged sword. Sometimes it tells you, look at the micro. Sometimes it tells you, look at the macro. So, you know, some people just say, look, it's true. It's true there's all these mitzvot. But it's working against us, right? People who would happily have Friday night dinner and would give their children a bris milah and would have a Pesach Seder and fast in Yom Kippur, right, have such a bad taste in their mouth because of the rabbinate's control on marriage that just to spite halacha, they will do all types of things they would never have thought of doing, so, right? So sometimes it's a mitzvah too, right, to be smart. Therefore, many other rabbis say no. And right, we saw before, right, Eli Fisher had just listed a bunch of rabbis who said that. But if you look at 16, Rav Malamud published a piece. Now, Rav Elazar Malamud is sort of a maverick posek on the Chardal side of the community, on the more, you know, Haredi side of the religious Zionist community. But he's also a maverick. Right? He doesn't really fit in a box. And he was one of the big advocates. You know, I'll say it outside, but you can read. This is his policy position, but it's actually a very nuanced position. And he's, you know, no, let's read it. It's really nice, right? He says, While we believe the state of Israel must have a Jewish character, we also do not want to cause grief to anyone. Nor do we claim the authority to interfere with one's personal life and tell him how to live, who to live with, or how. It is our religious and moral duty to criticize lifestyles that are halakhically and morally improper, but have respect and love for all humans, and acknowledging the value of freedom that is based on God-given freedom of choice, we must recognize their right to choose their own lifestyle. Some may claim that there is a religious duty to oppose and interfere with any type of relationship that fails to abide by halakha. I cannot expand upon this now, but it seems that such an obligation existed when there was a full public consensus favoring such a lifestyle, and even isolated offenders agreed to it in principle that their urges overcame them. Right? All those laws of coercion make sense in a world where most people recognize halakha as the binding law. They just might be weak or they might be rebellious, But he said, but in a situation like ours, the principle of freedom prevails, and our sole remaining duty is to protest against manifestations opposed to halacha. Moreover, an individual who fails to act in accordance with halacha should be judged favorably, for we do not know that we would have done any better had we grown up on the same conditions that he did. He said, we live, right? And he goes further. He said, the question therefore is, how do we strengthen Jewish character of the state without harming those who do not wish to live according to halacha? The question is likely to trouble us for many years, even when the religious become a majority in the state, since the question is of religious and moral nature, not merely a question of political power. So, proposed solution. To begin with, it should be enshrined in basic law that for Jews in the state of Israel, there's one mode of marriage, according to the age-old accepted Jewish halachas. Here's his solution. It's actually very clever. It's very nice. Here's his solution. Have civil union in marriage. I'll summarize and then we'll read it inside. Have civil union in marriage, but don't call it kiddushin. Why? Why would you say that? And before you even look at it, why would you say don't call civil marriage marriage? Because not. He said, look, you want to emphasize that marriage, right, Rav Stav did, that marriage is unique to halacha? Fine. Anything which doesn't go through the rabbinate, don't call it marriage. Call it civil union, but make it legally equivalent to marriage. But what have you done in that linguistic thing, right? It's not just a linguistic difference. What is it? It's a public statement that the Jewish state believes that marriage is through halacha. But it's a statement without teeth. Which is exactly what you want, right? He says, have civil marriage, full civil marriage by the state, call it a civil union, and kiddushin, right? Sanctity, sanctified marriage is only through the rabbinate. So then simultaneously, what have you done? You've taken away the coercion, but you've officially, right? He said, enshrine this in the basic law of the state, that marriage is through halacha, and civil union is through the state. He says, in other words, marriage, Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, is the sole path to establishing a family in Israel. This negates any proposal for the creation of a new civil institution of marriage. This is because marriage is a sacred concept based on the long-standing foundations of halacha, and the state must not desecrate it by means of alternatives or ceremonies that are not faithful to its tradition. Additionally, there should be legislation affirming the state of Israel work to reinforce family values, Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, including by strengthening the status of rabbinical courts and increasing the number of rabbinical court judges, so they may respond promptly on needs. He said, and here's my solution. Part of the compromise should be that more money is given to strengthening the rabbinic infrastructure. Why? Because we'll take away the coercive elements, but we will simultaneously increase their ability to be involved pastorally with people. Right? There's a shortage of manpower to actually engage people in a meaningful way. So he said, take away the coercive measure, but increase funding for people who can actually get people to love Judaism, right? So balance it. He said, similarly, family values based on Jewish tradition should be emphasized throughout the educational system, though without harming or insulting anyone who acts or thinks differently. On the other hand, it should be established that any two people are entitled to sign a domestic partnership agreement that grants them all privileges derived from shared life, like a family. It's not appropriate to call this agreement a covenant, a brit, because the word brit expresses sanctity and eternity, whereas the state must allow even partnerships that are devoid of holiness and or commitment to the eternal. Thus, the appropriate name for such an arrangement is domestic partnership, right? This proposal is of value provided that both sides of the political spectrum feel they benefit from it. Those faithful to the Torah benefit in the status of halachic marriage is strengthened in the state of Israel via its incorporation as a major educational value and through the allocation of all resources necessary for the optimal functioning of the marriage and divorce system in the rabbinical state. Liberals benefit in the individual gains recognition of his right to define himself and his life, and this definition is honored by the state through the granting of rights equal to those couples married halachically. Right, so he said, here's my solution, right? Cut our losses and recognize that coercion makes people hate religion. take away coercion, but increase education, right? Right, get more people involved, right? Actively call only halachic marriage kiddushin, right? Emphasize that civil union is not sanctified, right? It's just shutafut, right? It's shutafut zugit. It's just a partnership agreement, but not marriage. This way, the state has enshrined in law that we believe in halachic marriage, but that we're not going to force it. So we, right? It allows us the benefit of, right, educating towards a love of Judaism and encouraging people to embrace it, but without shoving it down their throats, right? This is sort of his balance of it. Now,
where was this originally published?
What?
Where was this one? It's in the blog. It's
well, the translation was in the blog. It was the Times of Israel. This is where I took it from.
This
is Eli Fisher's. I don't think so. I think this was a public opinion piece, right? He's very into public opinion pieces, right? Now, he actually, right, now another point of dispute we've mentioned before is what about homosexual unions? So he, and I didn't put this part of the piece, but he actually says, yeah, we should do the same for homosexual unions. He said, once we've made it clear that civil union in Israel is not marriage, so he said, extend it to all people, right? Homosexual, heterosexual, I don't care. Ruth Maidan and Ruth Gavison, again, even though Ruth Gavin is secular, says no, right? That even once we introduce civil marriage, they would endorse only giving it to a man and woman because, right, their logic is that the compromise has to be that we take away as much coercion as we can without harming the Jewish identity of the state. And they felt, right, both of them felt, that to recognize marriage, homosexual marriage, the state is not just is going to damage the Jewish sort of nature of the state because it's making a claim about the Jewish values in a way that we wouldn't be comfortable with. Right, Rev Malamud's solution to it is to distinguish strongly between our values and law. Their solution is to actually, you know, just compromise. But remember, they're also the ones who thought that divorce should be, right, kept under rabbinate, right? Their feeling is to much more keep it where it is. So, to summarize, right, what you have sort of on the ground now and the debates that are, right, this is sort of the debate, that one of the big debates that's reigning in Israel, right? So you have, on the one hand, people who believe that the status quo should basically be maintained, and civil marriage should not be an option. Now, yes, there are Haredim who believe that for political reasons or because for halachic reasons, but there are also, as we saw from Stav, there are religious Zionists, even liberal religious Zionists, who think this is true because they think that there is a religious Zionist value to having a chief rabbinate, because marriage is unique and defines who we are as Jewish people, because, you know, as Professor Shuchman said, there is a value to coercing halacha, and once we have the power, we shouldn't give it up, because tocha lifnei iver, you know, kfi al mitzvahs, all those halachic principles. And therefore say, the solution is to avoid civil marriage. Instead, the solution is to recognize that what we have to do is improve the current rabbinate, but basically keep the rabbinate, you know, with some facelifts. Now, again, Rustav, as he said, he's not pretending that bureaucracy won't create hatred of religion. He's not pretending this will solve all problems. But for the reasons mentioned above, he said it's worth the cost that some people will still hate, or, you know, Torah Judaism. But it's worth the cost because he thinks that much of the hatred towards the Orthodox rabbin can be solved by being nice. Not all of it, but some of it. And therefore, he said it's worth the cost for the reasons we mentioned above. That's one school of thought, even amongst people who recognize the problems, right? I'm not even talking about the people who don't recognize the problem with the system and just like it for whatever reason. But even people who recognize the problem, there is a school of thought which has made the cost-benefit analysis and said it's worth keeping the current system with just improving the niceness and the you know, so for example, right, he said, you know, for a while there was a law in the books that you needed to register for your marriage like 3 months in advance or something, right? You couldn't register for your marriage until like 3 months in advance or something. Like you couldn't register the date of your marriage because there were bureaucratic reasons, and then because part of the system is you have to go to the mikvah, and you can't necessarily figure out your cycle a year in advance. They didn't want people to do that. And he said at some point he went to the chief rabbinate, right? I mean, he is a chief rabbi of Shoham, so he went to like the higher ups, and he said, "This is crazy. This is just bureaucracy for the sake of bureaucracy. A secular couple is going to get married, even if they're going to do it through a rabbi, right? They have no problem with that. They live together and they book the hall 2 years in advance, right? What are you doing to these people, right? This is just bureaucracy, which makes everybody crazy for no reason, right? So when they come 3 months before, tell them to take pills that control their cycle, or whatever. Do whatever you need, but for bureaucratic reasons and neither reasons, you're not going to allow them to register their marriage, right? Like, you're crazy. You can just fix certain bureaucratic things, and then less people will hate you. Not everybody, right? Some people will still be angry, but just solve the problems that you have. That's one school of thought. Then there are these schools of thought who say, no, the exception to all rules of tochacha and the like are you have to cut your losses at some point. Right? And therefore, civil marriage, meaning making halakhic marriage not forced, will actually solve many problems. Now, how will you do that? So as we've seen, there are different schools of thought. Right? How are you going to balance the competing values, both the problems of mamzerut and the problems of our obligations towards the sanctity of marriage, towards other people's keeping mitzvot and the like? So, in terms of the mamzerut issue, you can solve it either through just possibly promotion, or right, Seth Farber's suggestion to include in civil marriage legislation a clause which says you have to say this is civil marriage and not halachic marriage. Now, what about the tochacha concern? So either you say, look, too bad, right? Tochacha is just, it's counterproductive, so we just can't worry about that, right? We've just got to move out of the coercive business. Or you can say what Rav Malamud says, which is, come up with some sort of compromise position. So his solution was, have civil marriage, but don't call it marriage, call it civil union, and enshrine in law that only kiddushin is marriage, because then you simultaneously establish the Torah position on marriage while taking away the coercive elements, and he then includes all types of things, increase educational funding and funding towards the non-coercive parts of the rabbinate so that you balance it. And he said once you do that, he has no problem saying we're going to endorse these civil unions fully for non-halakhic couples, for gay couples, it doesn't matter, right? The point is we can't be coercive about it, so we're going to create this model with no halakhic implications called civil union, and it'll have full legal rights with no halakhic sanctity. Yeah.
So how would that affect, Orthodox, conservative or reform people who want to get married and believe it as,
So I don't know what he would say, right? I assume what he would say is that, my guess is he would keep it under civil,
right?
Civil union. He'd say, okay, so get a civil marriage and then do kiddushin yourself, right? Right? I assume that's what he would say. Now, obviously, there are people this is not going to make happy because they say, no, we want kiddushin recognized by the rabbinate, right? Okay, right. Now, there are people Seth Farber will push towards, having civil union. But, there are people like Seth Farber who just say, no, let's just move to civil union entirely, right, who just eliminate the rabbinate, right? That's another school of thought. Just say, eliminate the rabbinate. The state will recognize civil union, and anyone who wants halakhic marriage or reform marriage, conservative marriage, will do their own thing in their private time. That's sort of more extreme than Rav Malamud, who said, cut your losses, and, Jews who want to get married with the kiddushin will do it. So Rav Malamud, it seems like he would not endorse conservative reform kiddushin, right? Because that's part of his argument. But he would say, look, you can't have everything, but they can get full rights, so they can get civil marriage, and then they can go do kiddushin themselves, right? It's no different than countries that force you to go to court, right? Some countries, Western countries, allow a rabbi to marry you and that be, legally recognized. Some don't. Sometimes you have to actually file paperwork in court and then you do whatever you want in your church or your shul or whatever.
But if you have the conservative reform rabbi marry you, though, then you'd still have to get a get according to the...
So possibly, right? So then you have to deal with it, right? Then you have to deal with the problem of Ramosha. So then if you possibly get Ramosha, it's not a problem, right? Then you'd have to deal with all that problem. So you have the middle position, so like Rav Malamud or Ruth Gavison and Ramidan, who say, you know what? Marriage will take away, but divorce will actually keep under the auspices because there's a value of unity of Israel, and it's worth the hatred towards the rabbinate if it'll maintain the freedom of future children. And, you know, Rav Meidan and Ruth Gavison's compromise that we won't allow gay couples because that's against our, you know, against the halachic view of marriage in a more frontal way than allowing civil unions. Right? Again, you can quibble with it the way Rav Milamud did, but their feeling is, no, we should make certain compromise, but not on gittin and not on, right? We can allow people to call it civil marriage for men and a woman, which is not halachic marriage, but they won't do it for gay unions, right? Okay, that's another compromise. Then you have Seth Farber, and, you know, in that school who say no. The solution is to get rid of the rabbinate entirely, marriage, divorce, everything, and just have civil marriage, and that's it. And then people who want to get married will get married as they want, right? But that's sort of the range of opinions that you get in Israel. You see how each person in their own way is, right? We're not talking about people who don't recognize the problems, and we're not talking about people who don't care about halacha, right? We're talking about people who recognize, on the one hand, the importance of encouraging Shmir HaMitzvot and the like, the sanctity of halacha, the problem of Mamzerut and getting all that on the one hand, and the reality, the recognition of reality on the other hand, that people hate, right, bureaucracies and are always institutionalized religion will always at some level create hatred. And then you get the range of views, right? You get the people, again, like Reb Stav, who say overall it's worth the cost. We can just fix it as much as we can and leave it at that. The other extreme, you have people like Seth Farber who say just cut the whole thing, move religion into, you know, the way it is in the Western world, and then allow people to do as they wish. And then people in the middle, like Rav Malamud, right, Rav Meidan, Gavison, who say, no, we have to make certain compromises. Right? They argue about which compromises to make, but they try to balance it. And you see that, you know, this sort of complicated issue has all these fascinating societal, halachic, psychological, sociological implications. And the range of, I think it's important to see in this conversation, is that all these people are committed to, you know, encouraging halacha, to trying to make halacha and Torah as part of Israel as possible without creating hatred, but which values you give preeminence to and how you make the cost-benefit analysis is very different, but you see they're all working, right, within the same principles, and it's a fascinating perspective into the complexity of having a modern state which is not fully halachic but wants to recognize, right, that Torah should have some important place in Israel, and this sort of gives you a range of at least one of the halachic issues that they're fighting about. And with that, I think we are out of time. So, shkoyach for this conversation. It was fun.